Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. This is episode 68 of Text Messages, Nonfiction Roundup. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. Late fall is always a great time to take stock of the newest nonfiction books for teens. By mid-November, most all of the current year's books have been published, and the countdown is on for awards season. That begins with the announcement of the National Book Award for Young People's Literature, which may include nonfiction books as winners or shortlisted titles, and it's followed just a few weeks later by the American Library Association's list of finalists for the YALSA Excellence in Nonfiction Award. In January, even more outstanding nonfiction titles are honored when the ALA announces the winner of the Robert F. Seibert Medal for Distinguished Informational Book for Children. Regular listeners to this podcast know how much I value book awards for their power to spark conversation and raise readers' awareness of exciting new titles. I'm especially thankful for awards that honor nonfiction. Because of them, I've discovered dozens of nonfiction books I would have never otherwise heard of. Book awards provide an excellent starting point for any reader who wants to establish roots in this genre. YALSA offers further support by posting an annual list of nominated titles, in addition to the winners, on the Excellence in Nonfiction Award webpage. Something that always inspires me when I start perusing new nonfiction is thinking about all the disciplinary worlds these books open up for teen readers. Nonfiction books can show teens what it means to think in a particular discipline. That is, what kinds of questions are worth asking, what answers are possible, and how experts go about constructing those answers. Nonfiction can also show teens what it looks like to make disciplinary knowledge relevant for a general audience. Authors establish this relevance in part through their creative approaches to writing. Because so many of these books are innovative in style and form, they give readers many different ways in to nonfiction subject matter. Some books are rich in visual material. They show the power of images to convey complex ideas and deepen the impact of words. Other books are powerful works of storytelling. They show how a strong narrative voice and other fiction writing techniques can be used to bring factual information to life. In this episode, I'll showcase the disciplinary range and appeal of current nonfiction by introducing you to 9 new titles that represent just a sampling of what's being published for today's teen readers. You'll hear about books that investigate the food industry, the media, and economic theory, the origins of the atomic bomb, and race relations in the U.S. military. I'll also bring you books that expose teens to different branches of science, such as primatology and bird watching, volcano monitoring, and managing infectious disease. Some of these titles are works of original research produced for a teen audience, while others are new versions of adult books that have been adapted for young people. Across the set, you'll encounter traditional research monographs, as well as graphic novels, picture books, and biographies. As is so often the case, there's something here for every reader. Works that invite teens of all ages to dig into important topics and discover new interests. The first 3 books I want to tell you about give teens new lenses for thinking critically about our consumer society. I'll start with Your Food is Fooling You, How Your Brain is Hijacked by Sugar, Fat, and Salt, written by former Food and Drug Administration Commissioner David A. Kessler and adapted for young readers by Richie Chavat. Your Food is Fooling You presents an eye-opening introduction to the manipulative science of food production. Although Kessler's larger project is to help readers recognize and manage the impulses that drive us to overeat, the way he does this is to explain how we are programmed to overeat because of the way food in our country is manufactured and marketed. As he argues in the first chapter, food is designed and sold to us in ways that make us want to eat more. That's in large part because of 3 ingredients: salt, sugar, and fat. Kessler shows how our response to high sugar, high fat foods is fueled by the chemical reactions these foods spark in our brains. because so much of the food we encounter in chain restaurants and the snack aisle of the grocery store is designed to trigger a pleasure response and amp up our cravings. This means that bad eating habits aren't just about a lack of willpower. They're about brain chemistry. One of the reasons I was drawn to this book is because it allowed me to build on and extend an interest I already had. That interest was triggered by books like Fast Food Nation and documentary films like Super Size Me and Food Inc. Your Food is Fooling You takes the conversation in a new direction by focusing on what processed foods do to our bodies and our brains. Chapters are short and easy to read, with bullet points to help readers focus on essential concepts. Older teens who want to delve more deeply into this material should check out Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, an outstanding work of investigative journalism written by New York Times reporter Michael Moss. Another book that will raise teens' awareness of media messages and our response to them is Made You Look, How Advertising Works and Why You Should Know by Sherry Graydon. Starting with an overview of the origins and history of advertising, Graydon shows teens how they are the target of today's ad campaigns and how their consumer lives are being shaped not just by the ad messages they see on TV, but also by social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, and sometimes even by ads in school. Highlighting the subtle and not-so-subtle strategies advertisers use to manipulate consumers creates a space for Graydon to talk about dozens of related topics, such as brand loyalty, mascots, product placement, guerrilla marketing campaigns, junk mail, and planned obsolescence. With cartoon illustrations on most every page, this colorful book engages readers through images as well as words. On some pages, the layout looks like a graphic novel, while on others it looks more like a teen magazine. But every chapter delivers valuable information through a mix of comics, lists, charts, and short essays. One of the book's most significant contributions is the attention it pays to issues of online privacy. Graydon wants us to know the extent to which our behavior on the internet is being tracked by corporations, so she explains exactly how that tracking process works and why we should be concerned. Then she suggests concrete things we can do to talk back to advertisers and make our reading of ads more critical. If Sherry Graydon gives us tools and vocabulary to deepen our understanding of advertising, then Michael Goodwin does the same for money and finance. In his lively and accessible graphic novel, Economics: How Our Economy Works and Doesn't Work in Words and Pictures, Goodwin offers readers a rich, comprehensive, and sometimes funny guide to all things economics. Anchored in a romp through American history, Economics introduces us to historical texts written by political philosophers, ideas like supply and demand, and policies like Reaganomics. Goodwin explains how economics is a field that's partially about theories and laws, but also about the infinite complexity of human behavior. War and taxes shape the economy, but so do the practices of banks and the spending habits of citizens. Using an array of graphs, charts, timelines, and diagrams, Goodwin illustrates how diverse elements work together to drive this abstract force called the economy. By including himself in the book as our narrator and guide, Goodwin talks directly to readers about why the economy matters. He argues that most of the issues we vote on come down to economics, and while everything affects the economy, power affects it most. This means that learning about the economy involves learning about the history of class struggle and the ever-growing gap between the rich and the poor. Goodwin makes these concepts relevant in our current moment by touching on recent events like the mortgage crisis, the Occupy Wall Street movement, and healthcare reform. Like the other titles I've told you about, Economics encourages readers to become informed citizens and see themselves as people who can work for change. The next two books invite readers into the discipline of history. The first is Trinity, A Graphic History of the First Atomic Bomb by Jonathan Feder Vorm. Trinity isn't the only book to present the history of the atomic bomb to teens, but in my view, it's the most compelling. Framed with opening quotes by the poet William Blake and the physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, Trinity uses a graphic novel format to tell the story of how the bomb was built, and then it explores how the world changed after we used it. The graphic format is perfect for showing readers both where and how the bomb was developed. Pictures allow us to see the inner workings of the atom as well as the desert landscape of Los Alamos at the breathtaking moment when the first atom bomb was exploded. But that's only half the story. Jonathan Fetter-Vorm goes on to recount how the decision was made to use the bomb. He shows aerial views of Japan and the cataclysmic effect of the bomb's destruction. Close-ups of two children playing on the streets of Nagasaki when the second bomb hits are devastating. But so are the close-ups of Oppenheimer's eyes in the moments when he considers what his work has wrought. What makes Trinity so memorable and affecting is how it weaves elements of science into its larger account of history. Readers are introduced to nuclear physics as well as geopolitical dynamics at the end of World War II. The drama and the conflicts within Oppenheimer's own psyche are conveyed through literary references to the story of Prometheus, the Greek god who introduced humans to fire. Trinity is as much a book about ethics and morality as it is about history and the atom bomb. It asks us to grapple with the devastating implications of human ingenuity, and it shows us how the world was forever changed in the wake of scientific discovery. Acclaimed YA nonfiction writer Tanya Lee Stone introduces teen readers to a lesser-known story from World War II in Courage Has No Color, the true story of the Triple Nickels, America's first black paratroopers. While many readers know that U.S. military troops served in segregated units during World War II, probably very few have heard of the Triple Nickels, a group of African-American soldiers who became the first and only unit of black parachutists during that war. Also known as the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, the Triple Nickels served at a time when black soldiers were kept out of combat and relegated instead to service jobs like building roads and digging ditches. Stone explains that for these soldiers, demanding a more meaningful role was a matter of human dignity. The Triple Nickels took it upon themselves to demonstrate that they were both smart enough and brave enough to jump out of airplanes, just as white soldiers did. But even as the Triple Nickels proved their courage and mettle, they were still treated as second-class citizens. By writing the first-ever comprehensive account of the Triple Nickels story, Stone shows teen readers how the making of history is an active, ongoing process, and how there are always little-known stories waiting to be told. In an essay at the end of the book, Stone also sheds light on the method she used to construct this account by listing all the sources she consulted. They include books and articles, but also letters, presidential documents, audio interviews, documentary short videos, full-length movies, print interviews, direct conversations, and photographs. Walter Morris, the first enlisted Triple Nickel and one of Stone's key informants, notes the importance of Stone's work for all of us, but especially for those whose story she has told. "Because of Courage Has No Color," he says, "our history will not be lost, and future generations will know the importance of what we endured." If the books you've heard about so far in this episode focus on American history and culture, the ones in the second half of the show introduce readers to stories from the world of science. The first is a colorful graphic novel for younger readers that celebrates the contributions of three women to the field of primatology. In Primates, the fearless science of Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey, and Birute Galdikas, author Jim Ottaviani and illustrator Maris Wicks present many biographies of these three women, including how they got their start in the field of anthropology and what their work studying primates entailed. I enjoyed learning about their lives, but I especially love seeing pictures of what fieldwork with primates is like. What do you do exactly when you study chimps, gorillas, and orangutans in the jungle? Ottaviani and Wicks give us glimpses of the magic and mystery of field observation. The long periods of waiting, notebook in hand, until animals reveal themselves. Moments of boredom, followed by moments of exhilaration and discovery. In an afterword, the authors explain the research they did to write this book, their reading, the timelines they produced, and the efforts they made to highlight complementary themes across the three stories. I appreciated hearing about key questions that informed their thinking, such as, what kind of person does it take to do this kind of work? How hard is it? When did our understanding of what it means to be a primate begin, and why does it matter? Primates provides a wonderful starting place for young readers who want to explore these ideas. Another book that introduces younger readers to field observation is Look Up, Birdwatching in Your Own Backyard by Annette LeBlanc-Cate. I love everything about this charming, text-heavy picture book. Like a cross between a birding field guide and a how-to book about drawing, Look Up teaches young people how to look at and listen to birds. That is, it introduces them to the colors, shapes, field marks, and songs that distinguish different bird species. But that information is presented as part of a larger discussion about where and why a person might begin bird watching. Annette LeBlanc-Cate launches that discussion by telling her own story. She's neither a professor nor an expert bird watcher. Rather, she's just a person who thought it might be nice to keep a nature sketchbook. As she began drawing trees, rocks, and flowers, she couldn't help noticing birds. Had they been there all along, she wondered, and I just hadn't been paying attention? Before she knew it, she was hooked. Because Look Up is written in a first-person narrative voice, and because it uses cartoon speech bubbles that allow birds and bird-watching humans to talk, the book is personal, funny, and endearing. But don't let the picture book format cause you to underestimate the book's substance. Look Up is packed with information about birds. It's also a call to readers to pay attention to the natural world. On the last page of the book, a cartoon version of the author says, "So many birds out there, and so few people see them. Be one of the people who sees them." The last two books I want to tell you about show how scientists use their knowledge to avert tragedy and protect vulnerable people. Eruption, Volcanoes and the Science of Saving Lives by Elizabeth Rush uses a picture book format to show readers the devastating impact of volcanic eruptions and the efforts scientists are making to predict eruptions before they occur. Rush focuses her account on an international team of scientists who came together to form VDAP, or the Volcano Disaster Assistance Program. She uses a suspenseful, day-to-day and moment-to-moment storytelling style to show readers how the VDAP team worked to monitor volcanoes in two particularly volatile locations, one in the Philippines and the other in Indonesia. In the course of telling these two stories, she introduces us to individual scientists and their techniques for monitoring seismic activity. Color photographs on every page allow readers to see the beauty of these smoldering volcanoes and the devastation piled on cities and towns in the wake of an eruption. Eruption helps readers understand the enormous challenges involved in doing the work of volcano monitoring. Scientists must set up camp in dangerous volcanic areas where they might not speak the language or know the culture. They might not have reliable electricity, safe transportation, or even basic medical care. Still, if they can use GPS equipment to predict if, when, and how a volcano might erupt, they can call for an evacuation and save thousands of lives. And yet there may be an unintended consequence to this work. Rush notes that even after tragic eruptions, people continue to choose to live in the shadows of volcanoes. If more died, would fewer people risk living in these locations? Eruption shows that there are no easy answers to this question. Finally, teens who are interested in thinking about science as a social justice issue should be sure to read Mountains Beyond Mountains, The Quest of Dr. Paul Farmer, A Man Who Would Cure the World, written by Tracy Kidder and adapted for young readers by Michael French. Mountains Beyond Mountains explores the life and work of Paul Farmer, a Harvard-trained doctor who specializes in infectious disease. It's a gripping biography that opens up world after world for teen readers. First, it's the life story of a doctor who also trained in anthropology and who chose to bring his special understanding of medicine, culture, and humanity to poor people in Haiti. Second, it's a story about medical ethics. Why do people living in different parts of the world receive such vastly different forms of medical care? How do we decide the value of a human life and the amount of resources that should be expended to heal any one person? What forms of policy work and diplomacy would make it possible for more poor people to receive more and better medical care? Third, it's a story about writing. What does it take to write a believable account of a heroic individual? What are the tensions involved in writing about another person's goodness? Mountains Beyond Mountains is one of those genre-blurring texts. It's a biography, but it's also ethnographic. It's a book about medical science, but it's also about liberation theology. It's about clinical practice, but also government policy and advocacy work. It's personal and honest, it's literary, and it's deeply inspiring. I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back to bring you a conversation with legendary YA author Judy Blume. Judy is this year's winner of the Allen Award for significant contributions to the field of young adult literature. She's also this year's winner of the NCTE Slate Intellectual Freedom Award. We'll talk about her books, her career, and the impact of her work on today's authors for teens. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at www.readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at www.readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening and look forward to more text messages soon.